Okay, ready. This is this le
le
nyeba
nyeba
le
le
el chewa
el chewa
le
le
macheba dam
macheba dam
mitepa
mitepa
chepa
chepa
shumisawa
shumisawa.
Page 34. It's on page 34, but it's a little spread out. It doesn't quite look like that. Okay. We talked last week about desire for this life. Alright? Renunciation is the medicine for desire for this life. And there were two kinds of meditations you could do, two long rings about desire for this life that would stop it. Do you remember what they are?
Yeah. Yeah, the first one is the great importance of this life of leisure and fortune, yeah, and the difficulty of finding it. Yeah. And the second one is its impermanence, the fact that we must die.
Yeah. Okay. So we covered last week, we talked about having desire for this life, and we covered the two long rings that are supposed to stop it. The first one is to think how lucky you are to be alive, to have a brain, not be too old yet, or at least not almost too old, in my case. You're still not too old to think straight. You still have some freshness of your thinking, and healthy. And then the second one was death. If you meditate on your death, obviously you will try to do some dharma, you'll be less attached to this life, because what we call this life is all irrelevant 30 seconds after you die. You won't care about a single thing in this life 30 seconds after you die. Nothing in this whole life will affect you 30 seconds after you die, except for what you learn here, or in a similar situation. Nothing else will be of any use to you. That's this life. You know, desire for this life is that. And it's easy to give up because it's meaningless. You know what I mean? It's not like you have to give up something that's worth anything. And it's not worth anything because it doesn't help you when you die. And if there were some time between tonight and the time you die, then it would make sense to try for those things, but you don't know. It could end tonight. So since you don't know, it doesn't make any sense to try for those things. Since you could die tonight, it doesn't make any sense to run after the things that you will lose the minute you die. Kempe Pobokam, in his long room, makes a nice analogy. He says, if some guy threatened to come to your house and murder you, but he said, I'll come sometime in the next month, in the next 30 days, maybe tomorrow, maybe 30 days from now, I will come to your house and murder you. You know. So if you didn't have a lock on your door, would you wait 29 days to put the lock on your door? Or would you put it on tonight? you would put it on tonight, and then you're safe. Okay, so if he doesn't come for 20 days, for 20 nights you sleep well, it doesn't matter. But it would be very foolish to wait until the 29th day on the assumption that he's going to come on the 30th day. And which is what we all do. We all think not important. We can have our careers, and we can worry about all these worldly things now, and then I can catch up on dharma before I die. Because life expectancy is up to 71 now. But that's an average, okay? I mean, a lot of people die before. And a lot of people die. And there's no order. I mean, younger people die first, sometimes older people die. Many sons die before their fathers.
Okay? Michael, yeah, can I ask you shortly this thing? It seems that to reincarnate as a human being is a matter of merit. But then on the other side, they give you this example of the turtle sticking their neck out of the ocean. It seems to be a matter of luck. So
it does. That doesn't refer to luck. That refers to the statistical odds of becoming a human. It's not luck. I mean, the example of the turtle is luck, that he comes up through the hole. But that's not the point of that story. The point is that that's how often a normal person can become a human in his next life.
So it's very difficult to accumulate merits.
Yeah, almost impossible. Like the odds against becoming a human in your next life are almost infinite.
So in the next lifetime, most probably, unless if you do something special, we'll not be humans.
No.
So I told them once that you get to be humans, keep going. No?
Not at all. The odds are greatly against. There may be a million to one or a thousand to one. The odds are against you. Because if you really check every one of your thoughts during the day, very few of them are charitable. Very few of them are the kind of virtue that got you here. Very, very, very few. Almost none. And they're very weak. And the ones that are, the ones of being irritated with other people and saying something impolite to other people, and being harassed or hassled by all these people in the subway and along the street, and why don't they leave me alone? I don't like all these people. And all of those thoughts are not virtue. So they're much more frequent. Okay. Now we get into how to stop desire for future life. Okay. We don't have enough sense to have desire for future life. Right? We really don't. I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't worry. It's not like I'm doing charity nowadays so that I become a king in my next life. I mean, this is referring to that. It also refers, Avoka says, Kathleen Avoka says, to people who, as they get older, and you see people like that, when they reach their 70s, late 60s, they start to get religious. And they start to pray that they're going to go to heaven when they die because they saw so much death around them. It's indisputable now. All of their friends are dead. They don't longer have any hope of a career past 65. They have no worldly thing that they're after anymore. It wouldn't make any sense to make a 10-year investment. And they know it. I mean, they finally reached a point where, most of their friends are dead. So those people start to get religious, and they start hoping that when they'll die, they'll go to heaven. I had a priest friend at school, where we went to school, and he would make the joke that he had a priest friend who was just waiting to die so he could get to heaven. That's all he wanted was to die. Because he was old and he was sick. Now I just want the reward. I don't want to hang around anymore. That's desire for future life. That's most of what people have when they get old and they're hoping for some kind of good future for themselves after they die is simple attachment. It's the same as desire for money in this life. Same thing. Assuming that they are not taking that with any kind of motivation to help others.
So what you're saying, it sounds like what you're saying, or implicit in what you're saying, is the distinction between going to some paradise heaven versus, say, to a place like Tushita heaven?
Even that, in Kempe Padoka says, he says most people who have a desire to go to that heaven have a desire which is motivated by a non-virtue.
So if it's motivated by bodhicitta, then that's...
Much different story. That was our first quiz, I think. Is a virtue necessarily a path to nirvana?
If merit brings you to Buddha.
If it doesn't have the three paths, if you don't have the three paths in your mind, no, it won't lead to it. Okay. And Buddhahood. Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about future lives, all right? And we'll talk about it in two senses. One is the proof for future lives, and then the second is the proof for the content of your future life. other books say, and I can look it up for you on a computer. There's a book called the Pramanavartika. Yeah.
Before we sort of get off the subject of last week, can I ask a question about
that? Sure.
Once we really tap into trying to generate this renunciation and see all the suffering, really, of all the people that are around us in the street, what's the sort of the counter to that big downer, that's the joy in life day to day?
I think it's anticipating, but it's bodhicitta. There's some kind of joy in... when you get the suffering of the world clear in your mind, like you're in your sitting in your chair, and that's the best place to meditate. You're just relaxing on a couch. and you're depressed by the suffering of the world. When you really get a clear picture of it, and it's much more vast than you thought, the people that you think are happy are also suffering badly. And it comes out, and as you know them, they get some disease, or they get disillusioned with their career, or they get knocked off from their position, and everyone does. So even the people who look like they were doing okay, you find out aren't doing okay. And then you get kind of depressed. I think then if you really get some kind of insight into bodhicitta, where you imagine what it would be like if you could help everyone. You know, if you could be of some assistance to all those people, some comfort to all of them, and you get some kind of vision of that, just in a fantasy even, I think that's enough to make you quite happy. And it karmically it should. You know, so we'll get there. Okay? Alright. First we have to prove future lives, and then we have to say what's going to happen in them. The proof of them is very simple. Basically, the texts say there is only one proof of future lives. Tsongkhapa, Jesokhapa says, I believe it's in Lamrim Chemo, there's only one proof, and it's simple, and it's difficult to dopa. What's dopa?
Realize.
It's difficult to internalize. It's difficult to make it part of your own mind. Very difficult. And there's only one proof, and it's very simple, and it's true. It's so simple that it sounds ridiculous to people who don't want to hear about it. Okay? It's this. It's very simple. Right now you have a consciousness of this class. Okay? You have an awareness, A. You have a stream of mind going on. And what the mind is focusing on right now is this class. Okay? The content of the mirror of your mind, what's showing in the mirror is this class right now. And what was it before that? And you can imagine it. By the way, if you get good at meditating, you can meditate back quite far. And if you practice it with good meditation every day, like a half hour, an hour a day, you can actually go back to your childhood something. You can do something amazing if you think about this meditation. But you just figure out, you try to remember what was the thought you had before you came in here. I mean, you can remember opening the door. You can remember standing outside on that street, I assume. Okay? And then you can remember getting to that street. And you can remember what happened today at work. And you can remember what happened this morning. Which means that proves the stream of your mind. Your mind does go on a stream. What you put into the mind now affects the way your mind is later. And Americans believe it 100% or they would not send young children to school, knowing that as they go through first, second, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, that by the time they get to 10th grade or 12th grade, they've built up the knowledge. They still remember what they learned in the first grade, or basically the basics of what they learned, the alphabet, the numbers, addition, subtraction. They're building on that until they reach high school or college. If you didn't believe that, if you thought that every time they graduated from first grade, they would forget everything in first grade and then go on to second grade without anything carrying over, you wouldn't send them to first grade. So American society believes in the stream of the mind.
Is this samsara? Is this...
We defined samsara last week, no?
Yes, but...
Yeah, the stream of a dirty mind, sakya, impure mind. The Buddha has a stream of mind, but it's not...
This is also that proof of that as well.
It proves the stream part, yeah.
But they say
that... But we didn't get there yet.
Maybe there's more mind as far as, you know, you can read some books around, you know. It seems that you will die together with the body and only your refined, your...
We'll get there.
Big mind will fly away.
We'll get there. Basically, there's a cause for your awareness today. The cause for your awareness today has to be another awareness. Buddhism, like Western science, believes, Western science teaches that matter, stuff, cannot be destroyed. It just changes, it transforms into new stuff. John Stilwell will die, the skin and bones will turn into dust, the dust will be in some coffin somewhere, the bugs will eat it, the bugs will die, some other bug will eat it, some bird will eat that bug. I mean, the matter, the stuff of John Stilwell, never is destroyed. And that's the principle of science. I mean, that's true. You can't destroy matter. And it's the same thing with mind. Matter, if you could trace it back, you could find all the different kinds of matter there were, all the different shapes it took. First it was Shakespeare, and then it was Abraham Lincoln, now it's John Stowell. Maybe the same dust, right? No, really, it had to have been somebody before. The dust in John Stowell. Right? And according to Buddhism, there's a kind of cause, which means main cause. It's called Nirlingkikyu. The atoms, the stuff that makes up John Stillwell's body, has to come from some stuff before. Period. You can't destroy that stuff. Every atom in you came from some energy or stuff before, physical stuff before, period. And science believes it, and we believe it, makes sense. But we say the same thing is true of mind. And mind is separate from the body. You can't burn mind, you can't touch mind, you can't see mind, you can't locate mind. Okay. Mind is invisible, and mind knows. And that's the only two qualities it has. Okay?
Yes.
Very interesting. Okay? So what caused your awareness of tonight's class? Or the metal for our car? What was the main cause of that consciousness?
Prior to that?
The consciousness of the day before. It has to be. I mean, consciousness, mental stuff can only be caused by mental stuff. Period. It's very simple, and it's very profound, and it's true. Mental material can only be caused by a main cause of other mental material. So, to have an awareness today, you must have had an awareness yesterday. The awareness yesterday is the cause for the awareness today. The stuff, mental stuff, that is here today has to come from some other mental stuff, as much as the physical stuff has to come from some previous physical stuff, period. It must. If you accept that one thing, and science has established it, you know, you believe it for material things, but if you accept it and if you think about it for mental things, what's the implication? Then yesterday's mind had to come from the mind of the day before. Must have. And the mind before that?
It's beginningless time.
The mind stuff is beginningless. Your mental stream is beginningless. According to Buddhism, it had no beginning. You cannot say this is Nitya's continuum's first thought. 5 minutes before that, he never had a thought. It's impossible. It's impossible. And that sounds, you can't accept it right now. Why do you accept that matter is, the physical matter is indestructible? Because you learned it in school. You never would have come up with it yourself. Why don't you accept that mental stuff is indestructible? You didn't hear it before. You have to think about it. It's true. It's true. Imagine coming to a class and having an awareness and there being no similar stuff in the universe to cause that awareness the moment before. It's impossible. It's impossible. So you have had a past life. And there is no other proof in Buddhism. You know, they don't go looking for some guy who remembers his past life, because who's going to accept it anyway?
Well, I was trying to discuss this with Lawrence, right?
Yeah. Among other things.
Yeah, right. So I kind of said that same example, and I was saying, well, you know, well, if it didn't, if that's not true, then, you know, then
right,
what came, you know...
What caused it?
Yeah, what, you know, when you were born, how come suddenly you thought you had this feeling like that you were you, and before that you never did? Where do you think it came from? And his only answer was, well, I don't know.
Yeah. No, we don't know. We're not taught it in school. We don't think
yeah.
about it much. Children ask the question.
But it's sort of like a brick wall at that point. I mean, wouldn't you, there's no way beyond it.
It's very, you can do it. I've done it with friends. I have high school friends I haven't seen in 20 years. And I met them recently. We spent a weekend in a cabin with two other guys. One is a Baptist, one is a Catholic.
Oh my goodness.
By the end of the time, they said, yeah, that makes sense. You know, what should I do now? And I teach them the 10 virtues. I think if you sit down and talk about it calmly and logically, And if it doesn't work the first time, if you hit a brick wall, you stop. As you will learn in Buddhist logic, you are not allowed to debate a person who does not accept the principles that you are using to prove what you're proving. I'll give you an example. If I'm trying to prove that my Honda is a car, okay? I'm trying to prove that my Honda is a car. And if someone doesn't, the guy that I'm talking to has to accept that if something is, well, let's put this another way.
He's going to accept what a car is.
Well, no, hang on. Well, I'll give you the example in Buddhism, okay? The classical example, okay? You sound something that is made. It sounds something produced. Sounds. Are they produced? Do they have causes? Yeah. All sound has causes. Sound is produced. Okay. Is anything produced also impermanent? If something has a cause, will it always die?
Yes.
Yes. No?
Yeah.
Kai said no. If something is caused, will it always perish?
No. Well, I would imagine that your Buddhahood, for instance, is something that's caused, and I don't know that.
It's
that
a difficult question. It does perish from instant to instant. No, it's a good example. It's a famous example. It's a famous example. Yeah. That's why the word permanent, the English translation permanent, is a little tricky.
Also, cessations, for instance. I thought they were permanent.
They are permanent. Mm-hmm. Are they caused? No.
Why would you go no further with the debate?
No, wait, hang on. Let's assume that you accept that sound is caused. Sound has causes. Sounds have causes. I'm snapping my fingers, they make a sound. Okay. If something is caused, it must perish. Let's assume you accept that.
Okay. Yeah. Because it's a relative phenomenon, it's related to something.
Now, suppose you go and you meet someone who says, sounds never end. Sounds do not perish. And you go up to them and you say, well, let me ask you something. I'll ask you two questions. Is sound something that's caused? And he says, yes. And I say, if it's caused, must it perish? And he says, yes. So he accepts everything already. He didn't come to the right conclusion with the right facts. He accepts that sound has caused. He accepts that if something is caused, it must end. The only time you're allowed to debate a person in Buddhism, and to debate with him why it's true that sound is perishing, will perish, is if he already accepts those first two thoughts. He already accepts everything he needs to know to draw the right conclusion. He just didn't draw the right conclusion then. You're not allowed to debate anyone in any other circumstances. It's very interesting. And if you think about it, every debate you ever win is simply demonstrating to the other person that he should have drawn this conclusion from what he already knows.
So you're not allowed because you won't win the argument?
You cannot establish the truth of it to him if he does not accept those two premises. Even if he does agree with you, it won't be true. It won't be because he's accepting the necessary facts and he didn't draw the right conclusion yet.
Is the point that he accepts?
And that's the only way you can truly convince anyone of something.
Is the point that he accepts your same premises, or he draws the same conclusions as you from those premises?
He accepts the same premises by which you must draw that conclusion.
So the point is not. I'm trying to understand. He has to accept the premises and he has to draw the conclusion.
He has not yet realized the conclusion.
So initially,
it's just drawing his attention to two facts that he already accepts. Which imply that you must accept your statement. That's the only way you're allowed to.
The premises to begin with.
Yeah, you check out the premises. You say to me, sound never ends. And I say to you, oh, it never ends, huh? Well, is it made? And you say, of course it's made. And I say, well, do all made things end? And you say, of course it ends. All made things end. And I say, well, then you're crazy, because sound must end according to yourself. And that's the only way in Buddhism you're allowed to argue with someone, technically.
And if they don't agree with that, then you can't.
They're crazy. We call them Ninding One. By the way, that's another logical fallacy in Buddhism. I mean, you're not allowed to debate with a crazy person.
Where's your book right?
No, he accepts that everything that's made must die. He accepts that sound is made. And then he refuses that sound ends. He's crazy. Now, who was this argument made for? By the way, this is the classical argument of Buddhism. When we study logic, that is the classical statement. It was for certain non-Buddhist schools in India long, long ago who said that the word Om was permanent. They said the sound Om is endless, never ends, never perishes.
Essence of existence.
Yeah, something like that. So the Buddhist said, come on, is Om made? Do you make Om with your lips and your tongue? Of course I do. Well, if it's made with your tongue and your lips, does it have to perish? Of course. Well, then doesn't Om perish? Oh, yeah.
They said it was the sound of the spheres, and the spheres are, who knows,
there
since when.
Yeah, this is the first. So how do you get into this? Oh. So all you have to do is get them to accept that if something causes another thing, it must be the same stuff.
In the Zen,
apples.
They have this thing, and they say that enlightenment comes suddenly, and it becomes just as a jump, not just a mental continuum, right?
I'm not sure what it means.
No, I found difficulties to relate this kind of aspect of the Zen training where you have to jump, if you want. You have to jump out of the training, in a way, if you want to realize something. It's not a continuum.
You got the wrong guy. I don't know anything about Zen. Ask me about, you know, Swahili religions. I don't know. I really don't know. I know as much as any common person knows. I don't know. It is possible to attain enlightenment in a second, of course. But according to Buddhism, it must occur through many, many years of plain old morality, plain old thinking, plain old practice. You know, it's not boom, you know, from something that's not even similar. It cannot happen. We're going to talk about that tonight. So anyway, the guy... You can get anyone in the world to accept that anything that has a cause must come from a cause which is made of similar stuff. And whatever that cause is made of must have come from a cause that had similar stuff. And then it's pretty simple. I mean, but it's so different to the way we were brought up, it's difficult for people to accept. That's all.
Can you talk about a collective consciousness then?
Buddhism does not accept a collective consciousness. We wish it were, you know. The Buddha could share his consciousness with me. I wouldn't have to suffer. I wouldn't have to get old. I wouldn't have to go to the dentist, you know. Huh?
The collective unconsciousness, though, it should be there.
What is collective karma, though?
That's a different thing. We will all, since we are doing a virtue tonight, assuming we have three paths, we will all meet each other in our Buddha fields. We will. In our paradises. But that each person collects individually.
So how is it?
We'll talk about it. These are beautiful questions, and that's why it takes 5 years to go through the course. And you will see all those things. And these are exactly the questions that Buddhists had 2,000 years ago.
Why is it not possible for mind to come from a collection of other causes resulting in the arising of mind?
Can your physical matter come from something like mind?
Well, say you're baking a cake. I mean, all the ingredients result in a cake.
The flour is the main ingredient. The flour is what we call nyanangigyo of the cake.
And, you know, you break
it's
down
the main
flour,
stuff that comes into the cake. And it must be similar to the cake.
Right, it's part of it. You break down the flour and it has other stuff that constitutes the...
Yeah, what caused the flour?
It goes on...
The seed of the flour, which has similar stuff. So it has to be. You just have to think about it. Okay, I can't... And you won't believe it right away. I can promise you that.
What I'm trying to
but
get
over
to,
a matter of years, it will sink in.
What I'm trying to get to are there sub, in essence, sub components endlessly.
Oh, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. That comes in chapter 2. Abhidhamma Kosha. Sambhav Sarva Dushedam. That's a line. Yes.
I'm just wondering about what's the difference between matter and consciousness. Because Buddhism says that there's a point in time when there's a voidness, and there's a period of creation when physical matter comes into existence, why couldn't it happen that consciousness comes into existence if it's similar?
Universes die and are born, and that's taught in the Abhidharma Kosha, third chapter at the end. They're not made newly. I mean, the stuff comes from... Yeah, and especially the beings. Like, some people say, well, where did the beings go while the universe was being destroyed? They moved... Their consciousness shifted to another universe for that period. According to the Abhidharma Kosha. Yeah, according to the Abhidharma Kosha. That's how a world is populated. And it goes through how, you know, which beings come first, how beings come first, like that. They move from another universe.
So there are infinite universes in existence?
Pretty much, yeah. That's another debate. So around the third chapter of the Prajnaparamita, we'll get to that. Okay? All right. Having established to your complete satisfaction... that your mind was beginning with. What accounts for its content at any given time?
Television.
The new ones are rather extraordinary. Anyway. Not a good system. Someone screaming. I like it. We're going to learn the four principles of karma.
Yeah,
I need page 34.
Page 34.
Is this like the next step in the proof of future lives?
No, we've already proved future lives. This is now proving how. Now, what happens to you in your future life? What will your future life be like? I've just proved to you you will have a future life.
And you can catch up with the content.
No, you don't accept it yet, so I'm not going to push it. You don't accept the principles yet, and I don't have. We'll get to it. Pramanavartika, second chapter, 1997.
But so much of everything hinges on accepting that. So at point, it's about faith.
Yeah, it is at the beginning. It's called samchungi. No, it is true. But I'll tell you something else. The real principles of karma are in a category of phenomenon, which we call extremely subtle, extremely hard to perceive. Down here, in what we call apparent phenomena, are colors, shapes, sounds. Anyone can hear or see those who's not blind or handy. In the second category are things which are very difficult to perceive. And emptiness is in there. And deeper than that, and more difficult to perceive than that, is karma. It's interesting that the principles of karma are more difficult to perceive than emptiness. And they must, at first, be accepted on scriptural authority, not faith.
Okay? There's a difference there, right?
Yeah, there is.
Or
the Buddha said, who can't buy and know who knows all things, which we have to prove to you. Okay? And there is, second chapter of Pramavartika, 1998.
Which requires more faith than karma.
Okay. He said, what's that? Jinbei Longju Chimgide. Famous, he said, give to other people and you will receive. Keep your morality and you will have bliss. And he went on a long list like that. And that is the root text by the Buddha that proves karma. And the only way you can perceive karma is through deduction based on his words. You cannot see it directly. You cannot see it through deduction based on reasoning. On your own thinking, you cannot. Buddhism doesn't accept that you can perceive the truth of karma through your own thinking. We don't accept that. We don't believe that. Especially at the beginning, you must accept karma. You must perceive the existence of karma, the truth of karma, through scripture and through thinking, well, that sounds logical. But you can't come up with it on pure logic. We don't even accept that you can. It's interesting. You'll get into that. How to prove things. Okay, anyway, if karma existed, let's put it that way. Alright, let me see something.
Uh,
I can't believe it.
He says here, named it, well, anyway. Okay, that's all he says. He says, he's talking about correct behavior. Why should you be good for your future life? He says, you will automatically be good for your future life if you understand these four principles of karma. These are the four principles of karma. It's on your homework. Could very possibly be on your quiz. I better make sure before I do it. That quiz doesn't exist. First principle of karma. Please say Lei Nyingpa.
Lei Nyingpa.
Lei Nyingpa.
Lei Nyingpa.
Lei means karma.
Karma.
In colloquial Tibetan, lega means work. What's your lega? What kind of line of work are you in? Lei. Work. Three ways to commit lei. How? Three ways to do lei.
Body, speech, and mind.
Yeah, body, speech, and mind.
Which is really one, right?
Well, mind comes first. You think to do something, and then you move your body or your tongue. The driver is.
But even if you just commit an act of mind, you could build karma.
Sure. A simple. That's why we say three kinds of karma. The act of thinking is karma. Lele jikte nato ke. Lene sambo de ne che.
That's what Bodhicitta is.
Fourth chapter of Abhidharma Kosha, opening lines.
I mean,
oh, absolutely, it is a karma.
Yeah.
But just the act of any act of thinking is karma. And actually, the definition of karma is the act of thinking. Lady, symbol, dang dei che, and what those acts of thinking inspire in your body and tongue.
How does such a twisted concept of karma get out there in the world when it's such a simple, clear definition?
Well, I think in Buddhist literature, the fact of thinking and the power created by it are sometimes also blurred together. They are separate things. The act of thinking is a mental stuff. Thinking is mental stuff. The power that's thereby created, the seed which is thereby created, is not mental stuff. It's what we call something changeable that's neither mental nor physical. In case of Demiduchi. A changing non-mental, non-physical epithet. Yeah, they sometimes blur together in Buddhism too, and when you're translating it into English, sometimes you have to choose which way you're going to translate it. Karma meaning the action that you do, or karma meaning the energy thereby created, which is going to affect you later. You see? It's difficult.
That's
and then schools get into, well, is there any difference?
That's where it gets far afield, because I think
it's
when
different.
People start to hear the energy that you created, they think of this energy that floats around Pluto, you know, like you said.
Well, we got to get into the emptiness thing. Okay.
Michael, doesn't it also impair results?
Never. But in common English, it does. Well, that's my karma. Karma never refers in Tibetan, in Buddhism, to the result. Curve is the Sanskrit root for to do. Kriyate is a Sanskrit word meaning to do. I did. Anyway, Lei Nyingpa. Nyingpa means definite, fixed, certain. First principle of karma. Karma is definite.
Does that mean that a specific cause will produce a predictable result?
It's very, very simple. What's the definition of good karma? Kylie? Very simple definition. Abhidharma Kosha.
That which, well, you said as a cause or as a result? As a cause? That which causes something pleasant.
Yeah. An action of body, deed, or body, mind, or body, speech, or mind, which produces an attractive result, is the definition of good karma. Good karma means any action which you undertake mentally, physically, or verbally, which produces an attractive result. Karmically speaking. We'll get into that. But actually, you don't even have to say karmically speaking. Period. Any action of body, speech, or mind, any thought, word, or action, which brings you an attractive result is good karma.
Even if what you're attracted to is not something good for you, it's still good
karma. Yeah, that's true too. That's true. What about bad karma? Just the opposite. Any action, what? It's Laura. Bad karma. Make up a definition.
Any action of body, speech, or mind, which? Not worthy, which produces a bad result.
Yeah, an unattractive result.
But how does, I'm sorry, how does that tie to that principle that karma is definite?
Well, then we're going to talk about it right now. The bottom line is that a virtuous deed, a good thought, a good word, a good action, cannot and will never produce anything but an attractive result. Period. So, Kylie.
The same as what goes around comes around.
If you're in our boss's office, Mr. Milgram, and you have just made a major error that he doesn't know about, and that you can get out of, but not by not saying anything, or by slightly avoiding, you know, not telling him the truth.
Means something that I can't fix and I don't tell him about anyway, or something that I can fix and I just don't tell him about it till after I fix it.
Something that you, some bad thing in business that you were responsible for. Okay?
Right.
And he asks you, were you responsible for that? And if you slightly twist the answer, you're off scot-free, he will never know. And that's easy for you because you're a computer expert. So computer experts can always say it was a transistor chip went off, you know. Instead of, I hit the wrong key, the computer blew up, you know. And if you then say it was a transistor chip, and if then he says, you're a genius, you know, thank you for your efforts, I appreciate it, you know, you're a good guy, and you did the right thing, that's a pleasant result. He praises you. It's not, you know, I'm glad to hear it wasn't your fault, you're a good man. Is that pleasure come from your mind?
Well, as Rinpoche has explained many times, the result of karma usually is experienced in many, many lifetimes after the one in which it was created.
No.
Well, he says there's three ways it's experienced.
Yeah,
in the
ways.
Same life it was created,
right.
In the next life, and in many lives after the next life. And he said the vast majority of it is experienced in many lives after the next life.
Mm-hmm.
So... and very few of them are experienced in this life. So I would say that it just must be some coincidence that the nice result I'm getting from my boss right now is from some other karma that was good. And I would be foolish to think that it came from an unvirtuous act that I just committed, which would have been a lie.
That's all. Okay. What's the opposite? Suppose you decide one day to be truthful to your fiance. And
just one man.
So you have an option to tell the truth about something that you know she'll be angry. You know she's gonna get angry. And that hurts. You. So but you decide that it's better to do it. And if you then tell the absolute straight God's truth, and then she gets very angry and screams at you. Something very unattractive. Did the truth cause the anger?
No.
Well, I think if you're an angry person, you're an angry person, no matter what people tell you.
No. If emptiness is true, that's not a true statement.
No, I'm saying if you allow anger to hang around in your mind, you know, and be ready to make an appearance. If you have a choice to react to things, and that's a habitual choice of yours to react in anger.
Wait, I'm just asking a simple question.
Did telling the
truth result in a bad result, an unattractive result, or yelling at him.
Well, by its very definition, telling the truth is something virtuous, so how could it produce something that was bad?
Cannot, but we live our lives based on the opposite. We live our lives exactly on the opposite. You really do. And I will go to work tomorrow and I'll do it again. And I'm teaching it and I'm knowing it for years. It's your nature. It's human nature, you know? But start thinking this way and something's incredible will happen, you know? People, for no reason at all, which is usually the way it goes, get very upset with you or they fire you or they scream at you or, you know, it can be part of your fault and oftentimes there's no fault of yours at all. Or it can be wholly your fault. But they're screaming at you. It doesn't seem to make any sense. Sometimes you're at fault, they scream at you. Sometimes you're not at fault, they scream at you. Sometimes you're not at fault, they praise you. And sometimes you're at fault, they praise you. You know, it seems like almost random. It is. It is. You're experiencing results of different actions. Just think about it the next time you want to. You can tell a small lie, a white lie, and get out of the problem. That's not why you got out of the problem. Or you do a little bad thing that nobody's going to hear about. Nobody will know. It must bring suffering to you. Must. That's Langyapa. That's the fixed quality of karma.
Well, unless you do something to nullify it.
We'll talk about it. We'll get there. Yes.
Is that what they mean, you know, I hear people talk about purifying your karma. Is that essentially what they mean when they say, you know, say purify your karma is to go into a situation perhaps knowing that doing what's virtuous, telling the truth, getting screamed at, you're in essence providing the framework to have this negativity come upon you and experience it with some objective.
It's not a practice. It's not a practice. I mean, I understand what you mean and it's true.
It's true that
when the person screams at you, you can take some comfort in the fact that you've just worn out a lousy karma.
Have you,
You have. Yeah. If you react with any kind of being upset, you've just created exactly the same karma again, and you'll be yelled at again.
So if you hadn't created that opportunity for them to yell at you, you would not have
not true.
Experienced that karma.
That part is not true. You see, you could have done a proper Mahayana purification in the comfort of your own home.
Which we'll get to in
year 3. No,
and not have to be.
But actually, at that point, you have no choice. You have no choice. You have to tell the truth. You have no choice.
The choice is to purify now or later, to bear
it's
the results.
It's not so much
to
purify, it's just that you want to create good karma.
Yeah, for the future.
You have to tell the truth. There is no other option.
Michael, the example that you gave the first lesson, right, that when you lie, then you create some profit for your boss, and for is the result of a good karma, but still, between you and yourself at night, you remain the fact that you lied.
Although I do lie.
You're not following a moral setup.
But what will let you follow, you see? Why is it that we're still lying? Why is it that I'm still lying after 4 years of life and after 20 years of Buddhist education?
Because we believe that we can defend ourselves.
It's your instincts. It is your instincts. And it's because I didn't study well enough. Or I didn't meditate on what I knew.
What about when people sort of demand that you lie to them? Like if you were being straightforward in business, no business would ever get done. Like, come on, tell me another one. You know?
It's not true. It's not what makes the business succeed. It's so funny, you know? And that's why people bust their brains over how to succeed, you know? It's so funny. No book ever written that didn't have these four principles in it about how to succeed was true, period. You know? Those books are even contradictory to each other. I mean, Donald Trump tells you to do one thing, and what's his name? Head of AT&T. What's his name? He tells you to do the opposite. The head of Sony tells you to do that. I had to read all these books. My boss made us read them. You know, after a while you say, well, don't you remember the book you gave us last year said to do the opposite? Yeah, right. Okay. It's a very revolutionary concept. It will change your life. If you try it, he talks about when does the karmic result ripen. But there are constantly ripenings, even minor ripenings that will start to take place all the time around you. What would it be like, what would the world be like if everyone believed in that first principle? You know, people could never lie. You know, if everyone believed that that was true, in their own self-interest, no one would ever lie. And then what would the world be like?
Wow, what a statement.
No, what if out of their own knowledge, people understood clearly that they cannot lie?
It would be like...
And if you could believe everything that everyone ever said to you, because you knew that everyone in the world understands this karma, so no one can ever lie to me, it would be incredible. That's, you know, when we were in religion, the class in university, they used to say, well, the test of religion is what would happen if everybody were doing it. And they said, Buddhism's stupid because there'd all be no kids. but this is the real thing. Think about it. Yeah.
Michael, aren't there circumstances where you, I mean, I can think of extreme circumstances where you have to lie, save a life. Isn't there such a thing as a mix of
Well, we talked, there is absolutely a thing called black and white karma. And we talked about some examples in one of the classes we had. Yes, a bodhisattva is required to lie by his vows if it's going to save a person's life, for example.
Spare someone a great unhappiness.
He does get a bad karma.
He
does? Yeah. I mean, I checked it with my lama recently because people were asking me this question a lot. He does get a bad karma. He said, the good karma he gets is 10,000 times more powerful. The bad karma he gets, because of his motivation, is extremely minuscule, and even then he knows how to purify it the next moment. So, no big problem. Yeah, he's on home. So, no, he doesn't experience more than a second of an inch on his finger. So, that's okay. That's the first. Think about it. It's revolutionary. It's extraordinary. No good action you ever do will ever cause you any pain. And no wrong action you ever do will ever cause you anything but pain. Impossible. And you accept it with all other kinds of causes. Like Jesus is always talking about fruits. And that's why he's always talking about fruits. You know, plant a lemon seed and stand over it and beg an orange tree to come up. It's crazy. And you accept that it's crazy. A lemon seed cannot and never will, under normal, except for biogenetics or whatever, create an orange tree. Impossible. Impossible. They are of different natures. They are of different stuff. Goodness creates goodness. Badness creates badness. It will never mix. Impossible. Impossible. You accept it with seeds, physical seeds, then why not accept it with mental seeds? You know? No one in the world would plant a garden with cactus seeds in New York, you know, hoping that they would get an evergreen tree that'll live to the winter. It's crazy. You know, it's impossible. And it's the same with karmic seeds, mental seeds. It's just impossible that something good creates something bad. Or that a wrong act would create some pleasant result for you. Impossible. If you think about it the way a child would think about it, they're completely different stuff. Just complete. One is sweet, one is sour. Who would plant a lemon seed to get a sweet apple tree? It's impossible. Yeah.
So if our mind stream is started wrong. All of our past karma, you know, it's brought us to where we are. All of the workings of our mind, it's brought us to where we are right now, right? Those are all causes and conditions which have come together to create us in these circumstances. How does our freedom of choice come into play with this, our volition? I mean, how is volition separate than karma and mind? Is it? Is it not?
It is true that, and Tom often mentions it, you know, you've got to have some extraordinary virtue to believe in virtue. You know, it's almost a catch-22. And that's true. Unfortunately, it's true. You know, Buddhism, people say, when you read the descriptions of the animal realms in the Lam Rim, in the big Lam Rims, which you will do someday, they say animals special suffering of animals is that they only do non-virtue. I mean, my Lama used to point to the robins. He'd say, we see a fresh spring coming and the robin is there on the lawn and we're happy. And he says, oh my God, the robins are here again. Because he can't bear to see them. They
kill insects and worms.
No, they're looking for worms and they dig all around the yard. They go methodically through the yard, ding, 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 and they finally hit one. They go, and they pull the worm out. You see the worm getting cut in half and the worm is dying and the worm is running, jumping around and the bird is just eating it alive, you know. They create very bad karma. The animals are almost predestined, by definition, to go down.
Yeah.
They can't create a good. They can't do a good thing.
My question.
So people say, "Well, wasn't that unfair? You know, isn't that unjust?"
What about herbivores?
It's the way it is.
What's in the animal realm?
Yeah, animal realm is pretty much a ticket down.
Keep someone else from getting anything.
Yeah, but if you're an herbivore, you don't.
No, that's true. Yeah,
so
you don't collect the karma.
It doesn't work for that.
At least you don't collect the karma.
My question was, how does volition come into play with karma? Like, our karma has brought us to where we are.
It's karma to have the volition to care about karma, is what I'm saying.
You still have a choice.
What
your actions are.
Well,
if this animal goes to lower realm, one day it must be an opportunity for them to create a good karma and circle up back.
Yeah, that's the only way.
That's
John said about it. You wear it out. By suffering, it wears out. The power of it wears out. But even in hell, they're struggling with each other. They collect a lot of bad deeds in hell. People murder each other in hell every moment, so.
So is volition different than karma, or is it the same thing?
Oh, yo, we'll get there. No, it's a good question. It is a really good question, but I can't keep it until 10. All
right.
It is a good question, and don't stop asking questions, but I'll just tell you it's coming.
It's the chair.
No, it's very good. You stop asking questions, it means you're asleep. I have to wake you up. Yeah.
No, I was just going to
ask. Okay, good. Okay. Second principle. Second principle.
Le Kalchewa.
The effects of karma. The results are bigger than the cause.
Bigger?
Yeah. The
Can you break it down?
Yeah. Le means karma.
Yeah.
Kal means to increase.
Create.
Increase.
Oh, increase.
Get bigger. Chewa means bigger. Bigger and bigger. My temple's name in New Jersey is Rashi Gepelim. Gepelim is your virtue gets bigger and bigger. Gewa Pelwa.
Is that like
your
name,
Pelgi? Yeah, it is. Pelgi means like, what do you call it? Prosperity. Things getting bigger. Right. Very, very, very simple principle. And you'll accept it, I think, the moment I say it. I always give the example of one day there was a windstorm in our temple and a tree fell down on the roof of the temple. And my Lama said, oh, you go up and here's a chainsaw. You go up and you cut it off, cut the top of the tree down, you know. And it was raining and I don't mind heights, you know. So my Lama told me, and I was really scared. I was truly very, very scared. And I went up there and I got my legs around the tree and I got this chainsaw. And so I was very scared. My legs were like shaking. And people were making fun of me. And I thought, at that moment I thought, you know, we have these big oak trees around our house. And they come from, what, walnuts you call them?
Acorns.
Yeah. And the squirrels come and...
That's kind of what I'm talking about. Trees from walnuts.
Sorry. I thought, you know, what if when this acorn fell down here 20 years ago, I had taken that goddamn acorn and thrown it on the asphalt tree, you know, it would never have grown. You know, I was just thinking that while I was cutting the tree, it occurred to me, if I had gotten a hold of that acorn when it was big enough to handle and thrown it out on the street, I wouldn't be up in this goddamn tree. It occurred to me, you know. And that's really true. It is true in the physical world that the causes are minuscule compared to the results. The causes of a human being are one cell of sperm and one egg, you know, or whatever. They are cellular. They are tiny, tiny, tiny little causes. And they create, you know, 50, 60, 70 years of human being. The causes of a tree are infinitely smaller than the tree. I mean, if you weighed the mass, I don't know what it would be. Those oak trees are like 50 feet high, 40 feet high. And the acorn is a couple grams. It's a physical principle that all seeds are tiny compared to the results. And it's true in karma also. It's true mentally also. A tiny bit of irritation at a person at work will make you suffer for many hours in the future. And hard suffering. You know, it's a cruel...
But then the good seeds are the same.
Yeah, but the good seeds are vastly outnumbered. normally. Yeah.
Well, I mean, are we making a distinction here between the sort of this apparently distinctive cause of that tree that you're talking about that fell on the roof, as opposed to the long stream of phenomena that produced that tree? In other words, the tree that produced the acorn, if you didn't chop that down too, it wouldn't have fallen on the ground,
right.
And then
that's
you would
true.
Have had to throw it, and then the
acorn
that produced that tree. So if you went three trees back and threw the acorn...
No, and if I went back to a bad thought I had this afternoon...
Heading for
sure.
Us, you could have...
They'd say that about, you know, liberation, you know, do it now or do it a million years from now, you gotta do it sooner. You know? It's true, yes. If you don't do it now, I mean, you're gonna have to do it.
So what's the logic then that goes into distinguishing between, you know, the acorn that fell on the grass being the cause of that tree versus 10 acorns ago that...
It is the direct, we call Yale study, Tagarik, second year, fourth course. Okay. Basic logic, it's about the third step. Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't want to sidetrack you too much. I understand your example, but it's still an analogy. I mean, you know, yeah.
No, I can give you a mental example.
Okay, that's good.
And it's very, very clear and applicable in your daily life. You know, let's say I have a guy at work who replaced me as vice president, and I know in advance that since we are going to be peers, or even that he will be my superior, that by the definition of a human being, I will get jealousy towards him. At some point, it will come. I know in advance. I know in advance of him getting. I know in advance of suggesting him for the position that I will be liable to have jealousy towards him. And if as the process of my substitution takes place, I actively watch my mind and don't let the first thought come. Don't let the first one come. You know, never let the first one come. The rest will never come. It's true. There's a famous, you know, the eight verses, a famous Kadampa, the early hardcore Buddhists of Tibet, beautiful Buddhists. You know, the first, you guys are the Kadampas of America, right? Okay? The Kadampas of Tibet, who were really the greatest practitioners of Buddhism because it was new for them, they said, what is it? It goes, Dhatta Shena Nirvichara, Chaudra Jagata Dobarjara, something like that. It's not the correct. But it means the minute you have a bad thought, the minute the first one starts, stop it. Do all you can do to stop it, because it's only going to multiply later. If you stop the first one, you'll never get 20 others that will come from it.
Okay, it's true that if you, you know, have a thought that goes in a particular direction and intends to set it, they'll speed the volume,
yeah,
like kind of like a,
yeah,
snowball down a hill. But how does that relate to the idea that, you know, if for instance, you said if you are irritated with somebody at work for a minute, then, you know, in the future you will suffer for hours or days?
You have to study the mind-only school.
Okay.
And we will.
Okay.
And it's really, really incredible. Because what you get a vision of, you know, this is like Dopa. You get this vision of a tiny little twisted seed in your mind causing your very mind to be poisoned. And as it, you can even see it and feel it in your mind, spreading through your mind, twisting and poisoning your mind. A small genetic defect in a chromosome, you know, causes this twisted, ugly baby, you know. And it's the same in karma. A small, tiny, defective thought, such as a moment's hatred towards someone at work, grows, twists. Even if you never have that thought again, karmically, through time, it grows and it gets uglier on itself. It twists, it expands like a human body does.
It continues to grow until it ripens?
Oh, yeah. All seeds. Give me a seed.
Like everything
else. Yeah.
But you have to put it in water.
Yeah, the conditions, no, and she's absolutely right, the conditions must be present.
For it to
one
continue
of the
to
conditions
grow.
Is ignorance.
So when you realize what you're doing and you stop it, there,
well, what's interesting is
cutting
that,
it at least.
Well, what's interesting is that there's a big debate, you know, do certain kinds of bodhisattvas or arhats, do they remove the seeds of their bad karma?
No.
No. They,
make
it impossible for them to flower.
Which is true.
Wait a minute.
Well,
arhats, no, they have to, well, but they have to, they, eventually it all...
Even the seed will be destroyed.
Yeah.
But the trick is, in the beginning, is to make, it's like the seed is still there.
Neutralize it, okay,
put any,
yeah,
water near,
no fertilizer.
You never let water get near it. You never let sunlight get near it.
Yeah.
Ignorance is water. In fact, in the fourth chapter, third chapter, Abhidhamma Kosha, okay, describes ignorance as like water. Then your bad deeds can flower.
I always wonder how you're going to purify so many bazillion lifetimes of stuff, you know, in just one lifetime. That's...
Yeah.
Well, there is a class of karmic seeds that will never come to fruition, right, which would be the bad karmic seeds of a Buddha that have been neutralized or purified, right?
They don't exist anymore.
They don't exist anymore?
At the eighth level of the Bodhisattva's levels, they are destroyed. Mm-hmm. Rigpa Bhaktan, especially the seed figures.
So then those would be seeds that would never be produce anything because they would destroy.
They would actually be destroyed. Okay. Say, Lema Chepa.
Lema Chepa.
Dham Chepa. So for number two, just get that vision of a tiny, lousy defect. Twisting, growing. It's true. It is true. And it's true of any twisted thing you see in nature. It came from one small defect in the seed. Okay. Le means what?
Cause.
Karma. What does Ma mean in Tibetan usually?
Not.
Okay. Shepa means did. Past tense of to do. Did. Did. Dung means?
And.
And. Machepa. Ma means what?
Not something.
Not. Che means to touch, make contact. Okay? Te. Te means when two things touch or make contact.
And pause.
What do you guess it means? Che is part of that verb to make contact. It's also the past part of the verb. Did. What do you think it means? I'll ask. Le mate? Le mate?
If you do not do the karma,
then mate.
Then I won't touch it.
Yeah, the result cannot come to you. Okay. You will never meet up with the result. It seems almost foolishly simple.
So le is karma, ma is not,
yeah.
Jipa is did.
This and means then, and then,
and then.
Jite. You'll never bump into that result. That result will never come to you. Impossible.
Me is never?
Me means not.
Not.
Jipa means to.
Ma and me?
Excuse me?
Both ma and
yeah.
Me.
Yeah. Ma mi min men. There's actually four negatives. Which you'll never get to. If you don't do it, you will never meet that result. So don't go to work hoping for that promotion if you haven't done a virtue to cause it. Simple. Don't expect a tantric result. Don't expect to see deities and go to some paradise before you die. If you don't do any of those three principle paths, forget it. Impossible. According to the laws of pop karma, impossible. Yeah, how can it happen?
They say that Christ, at the beginning, the first Christian or Christ himself believed in the karma reincarnation, but then he denied because it was a kind of philosophy. Like on this point, seems to me that leads you towards passive. Being passive, like the Indians, they say, so what? Yeah. You're the result of thousands of life. We cannot change that. So,
I don't think it's true. I think the great Buddhists of India, like King Ashoka, they were social activists. I mean, he built all the highways in India. I mean, he took Buddhism to Sri Lanka. He took it to Thailand. He said, people. I mean, they were not. Nothing happens. It's not. Nowadays, I agree. Very firmly that India is paralyzed, and they say that themselves. But I don't believe it's from any pure understanding of Buddhist, any Hindu philosophy. It's just from something else. It's from some other karma. But it's not from the teachings that they receive. They don't teach you to just sit around and let people suffer.
It's very much into their culture.
It is, no, it's sticking in their culture.
Nobody moves, like in Mexico, maybe.
No, I know it's worse. But it's not the cause. I would not say that a correct understanding of karma would make you anything less than a very engaged, compassionate person. You wouldn't sit around like I did last night at a gala affair of Indian diamond dealers on which they spent $500,000. While people in their country are starving and suffering. I don't think so. Okay. Leid machepa da machepa. So don't stand there saying, oh, I hope this tree comes up, I hope this tree comes up, and you didn't plant a seed, It's like foolish. Don't expect anything good if you haven't done anything. And on the other hand, if you can at least once at work avoid a bad thought that you almost were going to have, you almost thought something bad about somebody and you caught yourself. You just nullified the result. It will never come because you didn't do it. It's nice. It's a nice thing. I oftentimes during the day I say, okay, I had all day, first half of the day, I was angry, like today. But at least, I was able to cut it off at 12 o'clock. So, okay, from 12 to 12:30, I didn't do anything wrong to make any bad results.
Like this third principle, going back to the same point that I was telling you before, it seems to me that, let's say someone doesn't have a job, right? So he doesn't even look for a job because he says, that's my karma, and if I don't have the reason in the past for me getting a better position or a job or some money, I will not look at all. So it leads him to being very passive.
But shouldn't he rather go out and do some good deed so he can get a job later? By the way, I mean, one principle that I didn't write up here, I guess, it's always later, right? I mean, you don't plan out. There's always a time gap between the seed and the result. I don't know why they didn't put that in these four principles. The Nagarjuna said a very beautiful line in the letter to a friend, Shijin. He said, it's very unfortunate that when you do a bad deed, you don't see a big cut open up on your arm immediately as if a sword had just chopped your arm. Somebody ripped a hole in your arm. Like, you squash a bug. It's very unfortunate, says Nagarjuna, very bad luck that as you crush the bug, your own ribs don't start to break. They will break in the future. They will be crushed. Unfortunately, there's a time lapse. And that's why we're still here. You know, you would never do a bad deed. If you started to lie to make money and suddenly the money disappears from your pockets, you know, if you start to lie and then suddenly all the money you had in your pocket disappeared, you know, people would figure it out. People would stop lying. You know, people would really stop lying. That's not the way it is. There's always a time, there's always a gap. That gap is what makes us suffer. Because then you have trouble intellectually, you have to tie the cause to the result, and there's some empty space between that. It would be very convenient if, you know, the moment you hit somebody on the head, your own head hurt. As bad as it will. But that's not the way it works. There is instant karma. And there's extraordinarily bad karma that can give you almost instant results. Killing your father, killing your mother. And there are the opposite, which is extraordinary virtues in this life can create a tantric result in later life. And that's accepted in the scriptures.
Can you give some examples of the good immediate results?
Well, three principal paths. Practice them well in this period of your life and in the following period. You can achieve paradise in this life.
Okay. And if you don't
sit there waiting for paradise. It will never come. Your choice.
If you don't do the karma, you'll never meet its result.
If you don't do the karma, you will never meet its result. And if you don't make an active effort, you know, not even 15 minutes a day to write on your worksheet to do those three principal paths, then don't blame all those teachers who float to New York during initiations if nothing happens with your tantric practice. You know, that's your fault. That's your problem. You had enough time to eat, right? And do the other thing. All right. Say, le. Lei means what?
Karma.
What does chepa mean?
Good.
Yeah. Karma which is done. Chusawa is a verb, it's an idiom. Take out this me, and chusawa by itself means go, just go away.
Doesn't chu mean storm, I know.
No. That's the other chu. This is chu. You're not the Tibetan tracker, so I won't yell at you. Chusawa means just disappear. Chusawa means, I have to think of an example. It almost means like run away or
Evaporate
like that. If you have a box full of rice and you have a bad mouth problem, chusawa after a while, it'll just, almost on its own, it'll just disappear after a while. The cookies in our house tend to chusawa. Misawa. Me means what? It will not. If you do a karma, if you commit a karma, It must have a result. It will never just go away. It won't get lost out there around Pluto when it got hit by an asteroid. Impossible. It will never just go away. It's frightening. It's frightening. Every little bad thought I had at work today, I can count on a result. I can count on a result. Sometimes I feel it the next moment. I do something bad. I look at something I shouldn't have looked at. And almost the same instant, I'm aware, oh, shit, I just did another bad karma. It will not go away. I must experience that result.
Even if it's terrible?
We'll get in there.
He's going to be working really hard tonight after we leave.
No, it's very weird. Once you get good at this, then the minute you do a minor bad deed, I'm not supposed to look at a lady. I'll look at a lady on the street. And at the same moment, I'll feel the bad karma.
Why not look? Doesn't it depend on what's in your head?
Yeah, well, monk, yeah, it does. But
well,
I'm saying
so
with bad motivation.
That's implied.
But what I'm saying is that at that very, if you get good at it, and if you watch yourself, you catch yourself the next millisecond, and you're sadly aware that you have just thrown a brick into the future, you know? And you start to feel it. You start to sense it. You start to feel it as a concrete thing that is all, you just created it. And you feel it, and it's very hard, and it just went into the future. And you start
Do you know what my definition of Buddhism is?
Yeah.
Talking to yourself a lot.
Oh, yeah. No, by the way, when you start, I must warn you, okay, when you start Buddhist practice, I mean, good Buddhist practice, you start to, things get worse. Because you are, for the first time, noticing what's going on. Noticing what you've been doing all along that you didn't care about before and that you just let happen before is disturbing. And a lot of people get upset or they get sick or they go a little crazy. Or, you know, don't expect it. It will come. And don't get upset about being upset, okay? So expect it. And you get depressed. If your practice is going pretty good at the beginning, you start to think, I'm a bad person, I'm not doing anything right, I have such bad thoughts. You're just watching for the first time the thoughts that you've had all along.
Then how do you deal with that?
You have to not get too upset about it, yeah. I mean, you have to say, okay, let me take the worst ones and let me chip away, let me make some progress. And that you should be happy about. And take a lot of joy in that, and it's really powerful, it gives you great power.
But Michael, also, you said at the beginning of the class, for instance, it's so difficult to take birth as a human next time around, for instance, on this subject, okay? Isn't it also true, however, that if you take refuge properly, that's the reason you're taking refuge, is to keep yourself from lower births? Do you mean to say, even you do a great job and you take refuge, it's just so incredible that you're going to go down for a while anyway and eventually you'll come back up? Or is refuge really refuge? I mean, like, you know.
No, refuge is like a house that protects you from the rain, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you never go to that house, no, it cannot do anything.
But if
the act of taking refuge without understanding refuge is useless.
No, I'm. When I say taking refuge, I mean taking refuge. I don't mean somebody who thinks they're taking refuge and they're not.
Well, sure.
But I'm
sure.
saying, isn't
Obviously.
That the purpose of taking
sure.
refuge? That
sure.
no matter how difficult it might be to take human birth next time around, if you use that fear to motivate you to learn how to properly take refuge, then you should also not, like we were saying before, lay around and say everything is fate and I can't do anything
no,
about
sure.
it. You should realize that by doing that, it'll actually happen.
Right?
Sure,
that's
sure.
the purpose.
But
sure.
if you only take refuge once a day.
Well, the way that people take refuge
day,
is, oh my God, I gotta
happen.
Do it again.
Yeah.
We'll talk about refuge. We'll get to it. Okay. First chapter, third course. Lay chepa chimisam. Okay. Get into that mode of believing and sensing that you, when you do something wrong, and I'm not talking about killing people. The problem is that people think to do a better karma you have to kill somebody. No,
a
little lie at work. Taking something that wasn't quite given to you, cheating your landlord, slightly weaseling on your taxes, blah blah blah. The things that we really do all the time. It will not go away. It will. It must have a result. It will definitely have a result. You did it, and if you don't do some action to remove it, it must come back to you. It must definitely come back to you. Don't think that any little bad thing you did today will not have a result. It will have a result. bigger one. And a bad one, if it was a bad act. Okay, have some cookies. Have some.
Was this how to stop desire for future life?
Yeah.
Under?
Yeah, we'll talk about it. It's a good point. I didn't really tie it together.
Nyepa.
This one up here?
Right.
No, that's a different word. I'm only talking about the last word each time.
Bad thing.
Yeah. What are you going to call it? The problem.
Problems.
The problem of...
These are the six problems of a human life.
Oh, this is the title.
Yeah. Six problems of human life. These are the six problems that all humans have.
It's a mosquito.
Nyepa means certainty. Certainty. We had it before with Lay Nyepa. That was the first principle of karma. Nyepa means certainty.
Mepa, you know.
You guys know Me, right? What I say about all these M words in Tamil?
None.
There is no problem, Nyepa, that there is no Mepe. Nyepa means certainty. The first problem of your life, the first suffering of a human being, you don't have these sufferings of animals, like you have to watch over your shoulder all the time in case there's a bigger bird behind you. You know, they do. They do, and it's a very horrible suffering of an animal. You know, little fish, why do fish run away from you? And they spend their whole life looking over their shoulder, and the day that they don't, they get eaten. Okay? You don't have that, but we have all these. Nyepa maybe nyepa means there's no certainty in life. Anything can happen tonight.
Mepe means...
There is no.
There is
no. Yeah.
One of the problems of your life, and you may have noticed it.
You
never tell what the hell's going to happen next. And it's true. There's no certainty. You can't bet on anything. There's no certainty in life. There isn't. Especially if karma is true, and if your karmic pocket could have just about anything in it. Any terrible thing could happen to you. No, I don't know. Not sure.
Not sure about anything.
Except taxes and debt.
Talk a lot about
death
taxes
and taxes.
Dorothy
Pack.
No,
I'm
paying. Okay, the second one is Ngomba. Say Ngomba.
Ngomba.
Mepe.
Mepe.
Ngomba.
Ngomba.
Mepe.
Mepe.
Ngomba. Okay, what's Ngomba mean?
Bad
thing. What's a better word for that? The problem. The problem that there is mepa.
No.
There is no.
Yeah.
Ngomba.
Ngomba means satisfaction. You are never satisfied. You're never satisfied. It's a human suffering.
Such a drag, too.
No. I can remember, you know, when I got the job.
Mick
where
Jagger,
I worked.
1966.
Yeah. I got this job, they offered me $7 an hour to run up and down to the jewelry district with the jewelry.
65.
And I was thrilled. And then after a while they make you a supervisor. And then you want to be a manager, and then you want to be a director, and then you want to be a vice president, and you know. And then if they tell you, would you like to run around in this jewelry bag for $7, you say, you're crazy. You haven't changed much. About the same kind of person you were a few years ago. But you'll never be satisfied now. Human nature. You always want more. Always.
Okay. Number three. I misspelled this.
Okay, you have to fix that. Lu. Please say Lu.
Lu.
Young Me.
Young Me.
Young Du.
Young Du.
Doorway.
Doorway.
Nyepa.
Nyepa.
Lu means, do you know what Lu means? Or Ku?
Body?
Yeah, body. We had it in the two bodies of the Buddha. We had Ku. This is Lu. It's the same thing. Lu means body.
Yang Me, Yang Lu.
We have that in the definition of samsara. Remember?
Again and again.
Yeah, over and over. Yeah, over and over. We have that in the definition of samsara.
Yang Me, Yang Lu.
Dorwa. Dorwa means to discard, to throw off, shed. Nyepa means problem. What does it mean, Leon?
Keep
how do you pronounce it? I mean, how do you translate it from the back?
Dorwa means
problem of discard.
Starting over and over again the body.
Yeah. Okay. The problem that you have to get it again, die. Over and over and over and over.
But that's not just a human existence.
Right, that's true. But this is listed in the sixth.
Okay.
That's true. You have to keep shucking off bodies. You can only, it only has meaning. This is difficult. The first two have immediate meaning to you and to me. You know, I know that nothing in my life is certain. I know that I'm not satisfied, ever. I never get enough. But this one is hard because you don't really accept the future life. It's not in your culture to accept the future life. And it's hard. But if your mind has no beginning, then how many bodies have you shucked off? Countless.
Just countless.
I mean, you could pile them up. I mean, you could pile them as high as Mount Everest. Dead bodies. Rotting bodies. Okay? Bodies have done still well since, a couple hundred years, okay? No longer, right? Give it a
millennia.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, no, the pile would be bigger than the planet. I mean, it would reach the sun. The pile of dead bodies.
And you get into this existential question of, are they everybody else's bodies?
Michael, what is the whole meaning of the number three?
Number three, the third problem of our life is that we have to keep giving up this body again and again. It means we have to die again and again. Then we have to go find a new body. All the bodies that Rujira had, if you made a big pile, it would be bigger than any mountain. You had many bodies before, many bodies like this. And you had each one you had to leave. You have to give up, then you have to go find another one.
You know, discussing it in this way, the problem of having to give up bodies over and over again, it seems that it implies that you don't have to do that. You know, it's
sure.
possible to have a permanent body.
Sure.
Okay. Now, that's something that a lot of people don't seem to get, at least in this culture anyway, Is that something that's implied in Asia, that people just know that that's the case and we just haven't gone around to doing that? Or
no, not at all.
Because it doesn't say, I don't see the big news or the big list including something that says, you don't have to
you
can have a permanent body.
It's
you never see it listed.
It's implied when you're...
I find that a lot of people who study Dharma for a long time still don't sort of get that.
Right.
That the object is that you there's this state, there's this deathless state that is your more natural state than this one. Even.
But it's not static, right? It's constant. Even the Buddha.
He does have a body. The Buddha's body changes from one to as ours does.
But it doesn't change in the same way.
No, it has no suffering. It doesn't age.
Okay, number four. They say yang-yang,
ning-tsam,
jor-we,
nyepa.
What does yang-yang mean?
It's an abbreviation for another phrase.
Yang-ne-yang-du. This is the short form of yang-ne-yang-du. Okay. Yang-yang comes from yang-ne-yang-du. Yang-yang means what?
Over.
And in colloquial Tibet, they say yang-yang-yang.
Yang-yang.
Ning Tsam is an ancient word. It comes a lot in the Abhidharma. No, it's not that at all. It's the border between birth and death. And so Ning Tsam Jor means to close the border, which means to take birth again and again. And if you look it on the dictionary, you spend a few months.
The border between...
Literally, it means to join the border of between birth and death. But what it means, the meaning of that phrase is to take birth. To cross that border one more time. Okay? To cross that border one more time. Into life.
Ning-sham is crossing the border.
Tsam means the border, like the border between India and China is called Tsam. Ning-sham Jorwa means to. You can think of it as crossing the border. It's actually reconnecting into a new life.
Jorwa is closing.
Jorwa means to join. It's the word yoga. It's in, and it came into English as yoke, that which joins the animal to the car. Yoga means adjoining. It doesn't have clear meaning here. It's related to words for heart, but it's not what it means here. So what is that? The problem of?
Having to be born again.
Yeah, having to be born again again. So number three is the problem that you have to keep dumping bodies over and over again. And then number four is you have to keep being born again.
How are those two different?
The difference between death and birth, I guess. The drag of dying and the drag of being born. It's like having your car towed and having to find a new one. She knows very well. And it comes from Sanskrit words yoke, and that the English word yoke comes from that, which is join, two things. Say it. Yang Yang,
Yang Yang, Yang Yang,
To Mendu,
To Mendu,
Gyurwe,
Gyurwe,
Nyepa,
Nyepa.
I like this one. What's Yang Yang mean?
Oh, right.
Okay. You know, To means high. High. Men means the opposite. Low. What's take men in Robert, you know? Take men. Yeah, this is hina in Sanskrit. Hina.
Lesser?
Yeah. Hinayana. Men is the Tibetan word that they use in the word hinayana. That's not what it means here. It just means low here. But the word for hinayana in
because they call it low vehicle or something?
Yeah, the lower vehicle. The period.
Yeah.
Which, of course, the Hinayanas don't refer to in that way, do they?
Well, no, but I'll tell you something now. I mean, the Tibetans study Hinayana better than any Hinayanas do. You know, if you want to learn Theravada, go to Tibet. I spent 10 years on that. That's the lowest Hinayana school. The Hinayana schools are profound. Very, very high schools. If you could reach a Hinayana school, you'd be set. Okay, we're somewhere down.
We shouldn't call them that.
Not really, but compared to what you could be, it's Hina. But compared to us, it's Maha. Okay?
Doesn't it just mean lesser in the sense that your scope is...
That's all. Yeah. It's more restricted scope. You're watching out for yourself, which is not a bad thing. You will never lose that scope. Right? You don't give up the lowest. Lesser scope, you just build on it. But you still have that spectrum where you're watching for yourself too. Okay. Yang Yang To Mendu, Gyurwa. Gyurwa means to become. And Nyepa means problem.
And do?
To.
To. Also?
No, to.
To.
Think about it and see if you can guess. So well.
Problem of.
Go ahead.
No, you probably know it from some Dharma teaching. John's trying. Guess. I mean,
problem to become. Oh, problem.
I'll tell you something now. I mean, the Tibetans study Hinayana better than any Hinayanas do. You know, if you want to learn Theravada, go to Tibet. I spent 10 years on that. That's the lowest Theravada. The Hinayana schools are profound. They are very, very high schools. If you could reach a Hinayana school, you'd be set. Okay, we're somewhere down.
We shouldn't call them that.
Not really, but compared to what you could be, it's Hina. But compared to us, it's Maha. Okay?
Doesn't it just mean lesser in the sense that your scope is...
That's all. Yeah. It's more restricted scope. You're watching out for yourself, which is not a bad thing. You will never lose that scope. Right? You don't give up the lesser scope, you just build on it. But you still have that spectrum where you're watching for yourself too. Okay. Yang Yang To Mendu, Gyurwa. Gyurwa means to become. And Nyepa means problem.
And do?
To.
To. Also?
No, to.
To.
Think about it and see if you can guess. So well.
Go ahead.
No, you probably know it from some Dharma teaching. Yes. I mean,
problem to become. Oh, problem. The problem of things. Well, I mean, I.
Yeah, you're right.
The problem that, that after high comes low.
Yeah, basically. Whatever, yeah.
Whatever
the problem of in this life, you keep going up and down. One moment you're on top, next moment you're in the bottom.
This is the eight worldly thoughts.
That's not really.
Well, what is that?
It's a different problem. You get a high position in the city government, and in the next year they change mayors, and you're dumped down, and you're out looking for a job. And you join a corporation, and you shoot up to the top, and your company's shares are going like crazy, and then suddenly your competitor knocks you off, and your company's bankrupt. If you work in business, I mean, if you work in corporations, or if you work in, you know, competitive business for a while, I mean, you notice that it's just a big cycle. You know, companies are going out of business and going up, and then going down, then going up, then going down, then going up, going down. While you're on the up, you always think you're a genius, and on the way down, you always think somebody else caused you to do that. It's funny. Your life is just one roller coaster. That's number five, is the roller coaster.
There's a superset of the three sufferings.
There are the three sufferings, the five sufferings, the eight sufferings, the six sufferings. Number one, we're talking. In this book, he chooses the six and he explains why in the book.
Okay.
Number six, last one. Then you can go home, almost.
Say, Top.
Top.
Mepe.
Mepe.
Nyepa.
Nyepa.
Top.
Top.
Mepe.
Mepe.
Nyepa.
Nyepa.
Top means friend. Dropo.
Friend.
In Tibetan, the word Dropo means friend. Companion. I think companion may be better here. Companion. Maybe you know.
No.
Yeah.
There is none.
There is no. There is
none. So what's it mean? Read it backwards. That's the Tibetan always.
The problem is that there are no friends.
Yeah.
No
companion.
The problem is that you're alone, in other words.
No one can go with you. No one can go through this life. Forget it.
Oh, through this life.
Yeah, you're on your own. One of the sufferings of a human mind is that you're on your own. No one can accompany you. Especially in reference to death. Okay? You're totally alone. Forget, you know, girlfriend, boyfriend, wife, husband, friends, son, daughter, parents. No such thing. I mean, the basic truth is that you're on your own.
Even for people that are here, they are together, like they have a couple of friends and are married, and they seem very stable on that.
And there will come the day, if they live that long, or if they die in a nice way, that, you know, one will be holding on to the other's hand in the hospital bed, and the other one will go by himself. It's that bad. And you can be holding his hand, and he will go. We had it. We saw it the other day. So you can be touching him, you can be holding his arm. No, don't go, he goes. And you're alone.
Is the point of this that you go through life alone or that you die alone?
Well, you know that sometimes people for a brief period in their life
ultimately
are together. They have apparently a companion, but the truth is that you don't have a companion.
That's
you're
in all
on.
The six films, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously a lot of these aren't. Obviously, I guess all of them apply to the six. Also, but he's just using that. Last thing, one sentence, and then you go. By the way, this is supposed to make you realize that in your next life, no matter how groovy things are, they're no good. Okay? Still going to have these things. Even if you manage to pull off a human birth, it's very difficult. My lama says it's like winning the lottery. We still have these problems. I mean, when you get there, after you win the lottery,
won such a great prize.
You still have those things to look forward to. He's a secret plot. You already know about it. You're gonna learn more. Okay, please say Ninten.
Ninten.
Kuntu.
Kuntu.
Palpa.
Palpa.
Tenya.
Yerlo.
Chun Yerlo.
Chunna.
Chunna.
Deche.
Deche.
Minjung.
Minjung.
Kepa.
Kepa.
Okay. Nin means Nimo, which means day. Day, D-A-Y. Day.
Is that related to Nima, like sun?
Yeah, related to the word sun, Nima. Yin means day. What do you guess sen means?
Night.
Night. You know kun, I think. Kun. Kunga, the right word kunga. Kun means all.
All?
Kuntu means at all. Kuntu means at all. A-L-L. It's a plural. Those. There's a couple words for kun. Tamjie means all. Sanma means all. Kun. Tarpa, do you know?
Tarpa?
Tarpa. There's a book company called Tarpa. Why did they choose that? Moksha in Sanskrit.
Liberation.
Freedom. Liberation. Freedom. You know dunya. That was one of the three qualities of a good student.
Peaceful.
Nah.
No, near wasn't, because you have a peaceful.
Oh, that was near she, different spelling. You're right. Take it back. Well, yeah, striving for higher things. Okay. So dunya means to strive. To strive, to aspire. That was the third quality of a good student. Lob is the same as sim. That means
mind.
Mind. Exactly the same. Mine.
Exactly the same?
Except in the Abhidhamma, second chapter. Chapter 2.
So dun is to aspire or dunya?
Dunya is an idiom meaning to aspire. Jumna means when it happens. When it happens. Na means when. Jum means it happens. Jumna. Deitse means at that time. Deitse means at that time. If you don't know Engenjung, you're kicked out of the class. Yay!
Renunciation.
Engenjung. Renunciation. First of the three principal paths. First of the three realizations, which if you have, everything good thing you do becomes lead you to remember. Tired of life. And if you don't have it now, life will give it to you. Very convenient. No, life, the lamas always say, life is very, it's lucky that life will always reveal its true nature to you. It will always make you sick sooner or later. If you think it's nice now, don't worry, hang in there. It'll get lousy later. Nganju, kepa, develop. Developed, past tense. Developed. Developed. Lak means it is. It is. That's a law, by the way, just for you, you know, people like Rama. That's a law in Dashi La or Renchen La or
Michael La.
Yeah, that's the respectful. Your isness. It's kind of cute. Plot.
It's never clear to me when that's supposed to be a plot.
You all look at that for 1 minute, and then I'm going to ask somebody to translate. I'm going to ask somebody to try to guess the translation. Look at it for 1 minute quietly. Try to get the whole thing in your mind before you say it.
The mind that that strives day and night to achieve liberation, I mean to attain liberation, aspires day and night to attain liberation, has developed renunciation, true renunciation.
Yeah. This is the answer to the question, which is a lot of Tibetan texts will cover when they're describing a new mental attitude. They'll say, well, how do you know when you got it? You know, what's the
It's a difficult word in English to translate. I mean, in Tibetan to translate. What's the point at which you can say, I have renunciation? What's the tse in Tibetan tse? In Sanskrit, mut, like meter. What is the measure? What's that line? And where you cross that line, you say, now I have renunciation. I know I got renunciation now. Okay? Renunciation has been developed at the point when the state of mind where you want freedom day and night, all the time, has finally occurred. Okay? If you get that state of mind where all you can think about day and night is getting out of samsara, well, then you have renunciation. That's Jesselkop's definition.
It's a different thing. Like, the mind is strived day and night towards freedom, attain renunciation.
That's it. It's
renunciation.
Is renunciation. Then you have gotten renunciation. What is freedom? What's the opposite of samsara? What is samsara?
circle of
yeah,
repeating.
No. Come on, we want the real definition.
When your hips are
good.
Contaminated and don't allow you to perceive.
This chair, I gotta fix it. Nitya, you have to class. Can you fix this chair?
Yeah.
I still have that little wrench.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He remembers. He worked on it. It's a weird thing.
I can see what's wrong.
No, it's a weird
thing. Can't really put
only
it.
An Italian architect could fix this shit.
I had the right tool.
Tarpa, freedom, is what? The opposite of samsara. So what's samsara? Kelly, Mr. Kelly. What is samsara? Come on! By the way, that's legal in debating.
You want definition?
Yeah, definitely.
Samsara is the condition of having to take on over and over again the stream of impurities that you're forced to take on as a normal suffering.
So what would freedom be?
Freedom would be not having to take on the stream of impurities.
Yeah, so I don't think, you know, you don't have to be, it doesn't imply that you have to be depressed about it. I mean, you have to sort of aspire towards a body which would not have pain anymore. And aspire towards a state of mind and a world and a being in which your mind is pure and happy. And you're no longer in a world where, you know, you get the job, you go up, then you get to go down, you lose the job, then you win another one, you win the other one, you win the other one, you get another one, you get healthy, and then you get sick, and then you get better again, and then you get sick again, and, you know. It can be a happy thing, I mean, it can be a positive thing. You're really looking forward to a kind of mind which no longer hates anybody, and which is only happy with other people, and a kind of body that doesn't have that kind of suffering.
Somebody asked the Dalai Lama what the first thought the first thought that came into his mind upon waking every morning, he said, happy day.
Yeah, if you really, we'll get into bodhicitta next, by the way, next class. And that's the, I mean, that's that vision of really wanting everyone around you to be happy. And it's really nice. It's really nice. Okay.
Michael, the way you say it, it seems to negate the life. Period. Don't you mean to negate impure life?
That's what I said.
No, you said life. Well, life is life, and life's
life as you know it right now.
Yeah, but I mean, if you don't make that distinction, a lot of people have misinterpreted Buddhism over the years to mean something that negates life altogether. You know,
of course,
nothingness and so on.
That's why we give the definition.
Oh no, holes again.
So. Somebody would have volunteered to make the holes before class. No, I asked, actually, I'm trying to buy this paper that has holes in it already, so we can see it. And I asked the lady to get that kind of paper, she said, no, I'll just punch it for you. And I said,
so renunciation is kind of the downer you go through until you start to develop bodhicitta.
It is a little high. I mean, to really wish well of everyone around you, that's pretty high.
So it just is. I mean, just in a downer where you're doing meditation.
I don't know. For some reason, it seems to be. I can do it.
Okay, Nitya's doing.
For some reason, it seems to be.